Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And don't forget that in addition to all the marvelous information that you get on this radio show, you can always go to my website, Bregan.com, Bregin.com. I don't remind you enough about that. That will get you to the archives of this radio show. It'll get you to our video archives. It'll get you to my latest blogs about violence and psychiatric drugs and the school shootings. It'll just get you tons of scientific articles and scientific information. And my wife, Ginger, has created toxicpsychiatry.org, which is a treasure chest of scientific articles by other people and other resources, in particular concerning the damaging effects of psychiatric drugs, shock treatment, lobotomy, and so on. So there's a lot going on around us right now, and for whatever reason, I'm doing more media than I can remember. This week, I think I'm doing maybe five different kinds of radio shows other than my regular shows that I do, where I appear for 5 or 6 minutes and talk to a couple of million people, or up to 4 or 5 million people on a couple of radio stations, and just a lot of media. Canadian TV down here to talk to me, spent 4 hours with me yesterday, so a lot of stuff going on. I think the world is getting much more interested in the problems with psychiatric drugs and the psychiatric approach, and much more interested in empathic therapy approaches. Which brings me finally to our conference. It's rushing through time to collide with us, April 26th through 28th in Syracuse, New York, the third annual Empathic Therapy Conference. We nearly filled last time. We might, despite the economy, fill this year. Check us out. You can get to me from Bregan.com to the conference from Bregan.com, but go right to it, empathictherapy.org, empathictherapy.org. Learn about the conference, sign up for it. It's a tremendous event. People love it. They feel inspired by it. They not only hear critiques of biological psychiatry, they hear about the latest cutting-edge, most marvelous empathic approaches to therapy. I'm going to do a master class for 3 hours. Probably on the Sunday with Bert Caron, a great psychotherapist. It's just a really marvelous event. You get to meet me and Ginger and lots of other terrific people. So it's really a great, great conference. So, again, it's coming up April 26th through 28th. Get to it on empathictherapy.org. Well, enough about me. That was 4 minutes about me. I've got a really interesting guest. I'm actually looking forward to this session in part because, like going to a fireworks display or some other event, I'm not sure what's going to happen. Other than, this is a really interesting human being. This is a very thoughtful, creative, special human being indeed. My guest is Bob Moylan, and when he comes on, you there, Bob? Bob, you there?
Yes, I am. Can you? Yes.
Uh-huh. Did I pronounce your name right, Moylan?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Well, Bob and I, we first got acquainted indirectly. He got in touch with us, and I got two of his really interesting-looking books. They're sitting right in front of me. One is Emotional Core Therapy. And that's for adults, and one's for adolescents, Emotional Core Therapy, and then Follow-Up, Emotional Core Therapy for Adolescents. Bob's background is really interesting. He grew up under very unusual circumstances on the west side of Chicago. Single mother raised him and 12 siblings. God, that makes her a hero of motherhood. After his father passed away, very tragically in a fire. And he says that motivated him a great deal. He went on to really, you know, put himself through school with scholarships and hard work and, I guess, probably loans. Started out by getting a B.A. in economics. Anybody that gets a B.A. in economics strikes me as too intelligent to bear. I mean, that is tough stuff. At Northwestern, which is a tough school, through the School of Education and Social Policy, which is probably a little softer than economics. And then he got a master's degree at Loyola, another good school, in the counseling and psychology program. He practices counseling. And I think it's just going to be interesting to talk to him. Hello, Bob.
Good to hear from you, Dr. Bragan. It's a privilege to speak with you. I've read a lot of your work, and to me, you're not only the conscience of psychiatry, you're the Wyatt Earp of psychiatry. You're a hero for fighting the fight you fight, you know.
Thank you so much. You know, this comes up so often when I have people on the show that I've never met, and it's just, you know, in my older years here, it's deeply gratifying to me to hear how many lives I've touched. And I know you said you've read my books and they influenced you, and I'm really glad to hear about that. Well, just tell us about yourself, Bob. I mean, maybe start with this incredible childhood and how you surmounted it or grew from it. Just talk to us about it.
Sure. I feel like whenever I talk, I feel like I'm always protected anyways. I think a God has protected me. Actually, I grew up Christian Catholic, but I think somebody's been helping me out, but I think he's more of a universal God that loves all people, black, white, rich, poor, regardless of sexuality, religion, etc. And that is, I grew up one of 13 kids in a small family. My father was an alcoholic growing up, so I never had a relationship with him. I was very scared as a kid. He used to yell at my mother, and I used to, believe it or not, pee in my pants till I was 12 years old. That's how much anxiety I had growing up. I grew up on the streets of Chicago. I was arrested a couple of times before the age of 13. And what happened was, fortunately for me, I was kind of bright. So I used to study a lot, too. So I got a full scholarship to Lake Forest Academy, a prep school. And I learned from some good people out there from diverse cultures and ethnicities and et cetera. And I was very nurtured with my mind and my body. I was an athlete. I was actually the number one ranked boxer and wrestler growing up in Illinois. I wrestled Big Ten at Northwestern University, where I received a scholarship over there to go. But I think for me, growing up in, you know, quite alone, I didn't have a close relationship with some of my brothers, so I grew up on the streets, so to speak. I often suffered debilitating anxiety, depression, some anger issues, some addiction issues, but no one ever taught me. I was never really loved, so I had to kind of learn love for myself, and this took time and years, and fortunately for me, a therapist helped me. My high school guidance counselor my high school principal was actually a trained counselor at Northwestern. I got help with counseling, and so all throughout my adult life, I learned from mental health professionals, and even psychiatrists, by the way, that did one-on-one counseling actually helped me over the years, because when you have nothing, you reach out to good people. And you know, it's funny, Doc, I don't like to suffer. I hate the feeling of being depressed, anxious, angry, addicted to anything. And so I'm 51 years old now. I'm trying to be turned pro as a golfer this year. I'm working hard. I'm in the best shape of my life. Work out every day, exercise, do the elliptical and things like that. And I feel great with my life and mind. And I'm only 25 years younger than you. We talked yesterday about your age, and I think you've lived a noble life. Well, I hope the next 25 years I could give back to the world and help them, show them how to empower their mind. And speaking briefly, we talked about two books that I've written here. My next book's going to be for kids, because I'm certain that my process works, and I'm certain that my process can help empower people. So the next approach would be to help young kids from 5 to age 14 how to really live a life without drugs and alcohol, true to their spirit, how God made them, so to speak. And that's a key thing. And I've had great success in feedback with my books, and they're well received because they're very easy to read. If you can read Harry Potter, you can read my Emotional Care at the Court Therapy for Adolescents or my adult book. So, and it's funny because you know why the Harry Potter is meant to kind of bring you strong feelings of fear in the movie and grief and emotion, you know, arise your emotions. Well, that's what my book does. My books are very, very completely open about the pain and loss in life. And when you're open about it and honest about it and exact about the root cause of it, well, then you can finally get better. So my books talk about the cases I've treated over the years and how people get better, how they get empowered through their relationships. The key is how they learn from relationships. And, you know, it goes back to your, I'm very empathic. So I talked to you yesterday. We spoke on the phone, and you just seem like such a kind man. But I know you have a good, strong spirit, and it's not easy for you to fight the fight every day that you have to reach out to people to say that there's danger out in the world with drugs and alcohol and even pharmaceutical drugs. But for me, I'm certain there's an approach out there that can help people. And that approach is really to do what all people have in common. When all people, regardless of race, culture, ethnicity, etc., when they were young, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, they had a peaceful, reflective, daydreaming state of being. And I think the key of my approach is to do that throughout your life. Just like you're brushing teeth every day, you brush your teeth to get your teeth whiter, you need to stay in a peaceful, meditative, reflective state of being for part of your day. And then the next key approach of my approach, which is unique and it's different than any other self-help books out there, is that I come up with the idea that there's 4 true feelings. When you go towards something you like, there's joy. When you leave it, there's grief. When you go towards something you don't like, there's fear. When you leave that, there's relief. And the key is, is for any of our loved ones, you know, they go out in the world. Like my daughter's 16, she's going to go out to college in another year. I know that there's going to be pain where she goes to school. I know there's going to be fear and there's going to be grief. And so I gave her my teen book, like there's a way to protect her. And my books are really about protecting people in the sense that I'm very open about feelings and how they occur. And then when you're open and honest about them, well, then you can finally get better and deal with them. And these 4 feelings, by the way, they're temporary states of being. So I don't want anybody to feel like they can't get over pain and loss in life. You know, sometimes it takes doctor breaking. Sometimes it takes 6 months to a year. I have a client right now, she lost her husband after 25 years. And that's a sad thing. And it might take a couple years to get over, if not ever. But the key is to learn to release that feelings. And there's different ways to do it. My books talk about, journaling, music, using, movies, role-playing, different ways to get it out of your system, out of your body. The key is catharsis, to cathartically release your feelings. That's what my books talk about. It's a key component of emotional core therapy. Sorry, I was long-winded there, Doc.
You're doing fine. I interrupt when I think anybody is going on too long or when I want to have something to say. I think you're doing great. I would like you to examine a problem that continues, I think, to just mystify all of us as therapists, and that is, how does someone with such stressors, difficulties, et cetera, so many difficulties in childhood, how does he become such a creative, good, and responsible human being? How does this happen? Because, you know, in the therapy field, there's this tendency to have empathy for the person who does wrong in terms of, well, look at what they went through and they endured and so on. But I find among my clients, they don't want to hear anything like that. They don't want any excuse making. They want to, you have to encourage them to even usually look at the vulnerability of childhood because they don't want it to be an excuse. How in the world do you think, what have you learned about yourself?
Sure.
That got you through this? Now, you mentioned a lot of good people who came through your life.
Right, right.
But heck, what about when you were 4?
You know what it is, Doctor? It's this. Is I grew up Catholic, and I got to tell you, I used to pray a lot as a kid. And I would say that our Father, and I meant those words when I was younger. So I would say, forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. That would allow me to cathartically release the pain I caused on people on accident and the pain that people caused on me. But it wasn't enough, Doc. I used to box in the city. I was a city boxing champion. I would get my brains beat in sometimes. I had my three nose surgeries by the time I was 25, and three nose surgeries,
what
two shoulder surgeries.
What weight were you boxing at?
I was boxing at 100 pounds, but I beat two Golden Glove champions the last year I boxed, but I was a Big Ten wrestler, so I wrestled national level all over the country for Northwestern University. And
so you're a powerful man, but small.
Right, right. You know what I think? You know what it is? But there's a lot of pain there, doctor. There's pain in losing, and I learned a great deal there. But you know what your point is? You made a great point. Where did I get better and some people don't is that I would love to blame other people for all my problems, the way I grew up, et cetera. And I've had some terrible things that I won't even discuss with you on the phone here, but I've had just debilitating. Like, for example, I had bouts of depression that lasted months when I was losing matches and things like that. But the thing is that these all occurred when I was younger. What I had to do, doctor, was not blame anybody else, but I had to take responsibility for all my relationships. My books examine the root cause of stress. The root cause of stress is when relationships grow together or come apart, and they evoke one of those four feelings. So what happens is, and I've over the years, I've done this with my clients over and over again, I've said, these are relationships you're choosing. Now, what feeling is that going to bring you? So let's take a look at
that. I got that. I think you're making a really clear point about that. I want to bring you back because your life is so interesting, and it's interesting to me.
Right, right.
I actually took out some of my feelings, too. When I was young, I was a really good runner, and I played football.
Mm-hmm.
Though when I reached about 16, 17, I wasn't like a star anymore. So I went through being the fastest runner in the many schools down in Nassau County, and then had to deal with not being allowed to go in that direction. I think God said, no, you're not going in that direction. I have other plans for you. But we have a lot in common. I wasn't a big guy. I was bigger than you. I was probably running at 130 pounds and playing football at 140. You said, you took responsibility. Where do you think, have you got any idea where that come from? And I look into my own self and say, where did I decide so early to be a certain way? Can you describe that, deciding early?
Yeah, you know what I think it is? I think it goes back to when I was very, very little. I used to play with soldiers when I was little. I just, daydream a lot when I had a lot of time alone. So for me, the real answer, doctor, is that I was very comfortable at like 4, 5, 6 years old daydreaming, okay? So all my life, I've had my brother killed himself 3 days before, or died 3 days before my wedding. So I fainted three times in one day, and I was depressed for 6 months. This was in my early 30s. I've lost loved ones. See, when you don't have anything, you grasp onto things that are not very stable. I've had such loss in my life. Even I went out to University of Pennsylvania for a PhD in my 20s, and I didn't finish. I got robbed three times in West Philadelphia. I came back home with my tail between my legs. It was a big loss. But throughout, what happens is, when you realize, I guess, what the real answer is, go back to your question, is I like being in a comfortable state of being. I love the feeling of my mind relaxing and wandering. So what I've learned is that these states are all temporary, So there, and it goes back to my approach. I read everything out there. Doc, I used to sit in Barnes & Noble. I read your book 18 to 20 years ago, Toxic Psychiatry. I've been referring to people for years. Just so
did you buy it or did you leave it in Barnes & Noble?
Oh, no, I loved it. Are you kidding me? A client, 8 months ago, one of my clients was able to get off his medications and start working out again thanks to your book. But getting back to the topic at hand, when you're comfortable, we have to teach our young this, okay? The prayer in the school was not right, why it was Christian-based. And, if you're sitting there as a Muslim or, as a Buddhist or whatever, that's not right for you to be outcast. My approach is for everyone, Doc, because everyone can have a peaceful, reflective state of being, and when they're younger, they have to. So I teach people in my book how to have it. There's different ways how they have it. Most people get confused with meditation because you don't want
to. Let me bring you back. I really would love to talk more with you about yourself. Can I do that for just a few
minutes?
Sure,
sure, sure. Uh-huh.
And I'll let you go, and we can talk more about your current theories. I think folks are getting a really good idea that you're interesting and that your books are going to approach some interesting ideas, and I think you're making those really clear. But I want to come back. If you don't mind, what's your earliest memory of wanting to be responsible or wanting to be idealistic? I mean, you're in this chaos. You're growing up in chaos.
Right.
You're creating like a bubble you're describing for yourself of of a kind of a meditative state, a meditative world.
Right, right.
As a little kid, you find this yourself, mm-hmm. and that's giving you strength and peace, is part of what you're saying.
Right, right.
And but you're contending with an alcoholic father. When does he die or leave?
He died when I was 13, but we had actually started our house on fire with smoking and drinking, and we kicked him out. And about a month later, he died in a fire where he was 46 at the time, and it was a 22-year-old man that was died in a fire along with a bunch of people displaced.
That your father did.
My father died, yeah, in that fire.
And he created this fire?
Yeah, I don't know that he created it. I was 13 years old at the time. But the idea was that I never had a relationship with him. My only relationship with him was being terrorized every day because I used to feel like he would yell at my mother. And I still remember to this day what he would, the swear words he would yell at my mother when he was drunk. And I had a close relationship with my mother. I dreamed of her all the time. She was working as a waitress while I was growing up, but she was my protector. So for him to yell at her made me very uncertain and unstable as a kid, and that's no way to grow up.
Sure. Now, what number were you among these 13 kids?
I was the ninth boy in a row. We had 9 boys, then 3 girls and a boy, and 12 kids in 14 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Right, right.
And is your mom still alive?
Yes, she's 81 years old.
And so do you have some sense of deciding you would be different than your dad or deciding that... I mean, I'm listening to this story. You get the courage to box. You get the courage to wrestle. You get responsible. Mm-hmm. Man, when does that begin?
I think that's where I can relate to a lot of your viewers, is that there really it wasn't easy for a long time. I relate my early childhood to the character Nell in the Jodie Foster movie where she grew up in the woods all alone. I had years and years of suffering, and it was very hard. To be lonely and despair, and like even I went to prep school, and I used to wash the dishes at a wealthy Lake Forest Academy, which is the most expensive prep school in Illinois, and I felt inferior to those kids a lot of places. But over time I got to know them, and they were friendly kids, and I enjoyed spending time with them, and I was a good athlete, so that helped me. But pain and isolation and loneliness and despair were my constant companion as a kid and young adult. And what happens is, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You've had it so much, you hate that feeling. And you know what it is? Here's your answer, doctor, that's a place I don't want to be. So I'm going to do all I can to build support and healthy relationships and good things in my life. I work every day empowering my clients to have them bring joy in my life. And that's the only way out of this, besides being peaceful, is to build open, honest relationships with people that can bring you joy. And you know what's funny, Doc? I love a lot of life. I got to tell you, I love my golf right now. I'm looking forward to the next 5-10 years playing competitive golf and helping. I love my life. You know, I love people. I love to connect and help people, and that's a good thing. And there's a lot to live for, the trees, the water, you know, the memories of your past. And it's not only about me. It's about the loved ones in my life. Like, a lot of times my clients are suffering. I have them take a picture of their family. You know, if somebody's been depressed for 6 months, I say, bring a picture of your kids in there. We have to fight to get you healthy. We have to support you in this process, but think of your kids. They need you. I just ran a group today of 15 women, all addicted to heroin. I ran down the inner city to do this group, and I gave them all a copy of my group, book. They were all on methadone as a way to maintain their sense of balance. But the key about them is they all were inquisitive about the approaches that I used to get them better, and they were all suffering. And I had 2 of them brought in their children, which is one was this cute little girl who was 1 year old, and I said, look at that beautiful girl. I said, she's a reason to live to that lady. I said, wouldn't you do all you can to get yourself better? And the mom says, oh, yeah, sure. And there's another little child in that little group, too, just with the mothers were carrying them, you know. And so I said, you know what, belonging to people is a good reason to be. And so for me, you know, my own self, I have a daughter. I'll bag groceries for my daughter. I'll shovel snow. I'll do whatever it takes to raise my kid because that's a connection I have in the world. But I think human relationships can motivate us too. And my book really talks about that, is sometimes those human relationships go sour. People will get sick, ill, lose their jobs, finances, loss of life. And we have to release those feelings of despair and fear and grief. And so my book talks about how to do that over time.
I love your enthusiasm, and I love how you work with your own life and the lives of other people. Do you talk much about this core issue of deciding to master your life, deciding you can actually make it into something? A lot of people who come for therapy really don't have that concept that they can take charge of their lives, master their lives, make it into a life they want, make it into a good life.
That's a great point. It's the power of empathy. The power of empathy is to have the client sit back to when they were peaceful. Some clients, it might be when they're in eighth grade. Some, when they're in high school, they had a peaceful couple of years. But to sit and help them, give them the strength. One of the key things about my approach, doctor, is this. A therapist should never give advice. And that is because, you know why? We can't control future relationships. So all I tell them is, okay, this is a relationship you chose. What feeling is it bringing you? Is it bringing you a lot of fear or grief or a lot of joy? And then we explore what's going on, so I let them choose the next relationship. And that's a key component that empowers people. I'm all about autonomy, getting the people stronger. You know, I joke with people that my book is like a quick self-help book, like one of those books you used to read in high school. I forgot the name of it, but it's like a do-it-yourself, or like a really, you could read it in like a week, so to speak. In other words, most psychology, if you read it, doctor, most people can't even read it or understand it. My approaches are so simple that they can use it. And when they use it, they can transfer it over to other issues. So, for example, let's take one of my clients now is, she's seeing me for drinking, and that she had a little bit of alcohol issue because her husband is, neglecting her because he's drinking a lot too. And so once I help her with this approach of emotional core therapy, which is to help her honor her feelings and empower her with the relationships she has and learn to be more assertive with the husband, different techniques that she picks up from her own world, she can then use this in different areas of her life, at her job, with her girlfriends, In other words, once you learn the basic techniques of emotional core therapy, which is to really stay in a peaceful meditative state of mind, to honor those four core feelings that are temporary in nature, joy, grief, fear, and relief, identify them, release them, and come back to peaceful state, you can use it in other areas. That's very empowering for the client. Versus, let's take a look at, like, online, Heinz Kohut, a great psychoanalyst from University of Chicago. He's written three books, but nobody could read them. Nobody could understand them. So what good is it to teach somebody something that they can't use every day? My approach is something that empowers the client by helping them use it every day in all their lives, so they don't need to come back to the therapist. You see?
I got you. Bob, where do people, before we go to break in about 2 minutes, how do people get in touch with you?
I have two websites, robertmoylan.com and then IllinoisDUIcounseling.com, and my books are available on Barnes & Noble and mostly on Amazon, too. And they can call me. They can call me at 630-788-1100. I'm very approachable. I deal all day long. I'm like you. I'm a very busy person. But to me, our job is about service. When we serve, we're free, doctor. That's a Hermann Hesse quote. And the idea is that I'm here just by the grace of God. He wants me to help people, the same as you. And it's funny, as I talk to you today, our journey is not done. See, I know your work, doctor, is to help empower and kids who are basically get to see they are taking medicines and drugs that they don't need. One of the things we can do later on is if I write a book for kids on this approach, right? I used to be a school counselor for ages 5 to 12, so it wouldn't be hard to do, is to have people be informed, both psychologists. And I used to work as a school counselor, too, and a director of, I have a licensed overseas school psychologist, nurses, counselors in schools. And one of the things I've seen over the years is they aren't proactive about having the young kids learn from their behaviors, learning to soothe themselves, take responsibility. So these are learned behaviors we can teach the mental health professionals, the medical field also, to protect our kids. And I think that's where, I hate to say it, Doc, but I'm a little Wyatt Earp myself. And that is, I'm fighting just like you're fighting. My fight is to help anybody, whether it's psychiatrist, psychologist, anybody on the street pushing drugs or alcohol, bartenders, etc., to show that there's those things are not healthy for people. Those are relationships that likely will cause you grief and fear. And let's try to work slowly over time in a compassionate manner to bring you things that bring you joy. Like my book talks about, I would say yoga, Pilates, weightlifting,
church. We're going to go to break in a minute. We'll hear the music whenever my engineer feels like starting it. This is very interesting to me that you go back to a source of strength in this period when you had this quiet. I think I go back to early decisions about how the world was wrong and bad and mistreating people, and I wanted to make it better. I think that it's funny, we have these early ideas. I came much later to the idea of finding peace, So very interesting. We'll go to break, and then we'll be returning with Bob Moylan, M-O-Y-L-A-N, a counselor with a lot of good ideas. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And, of course, you're listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. My guest, a very interesting and inspiring man, Bob Moylan. Bob's got me thinking. This week, when the TV were in here filming me, one of them wandered over to my wall. I have only the required diplomas on my wall because required by law, which is my medical license and my DEA prescribing license, because I'm not here to impress patients with authority. You know, I have a very home-like office. He wandered over there and came back and he's, my God, doc, do you know, in a few months, you'll have had your medical license for 50 years. Talking with Bob Moylan gets me thinking about the trajectory of a life. And, all right, I've had the medical license for 50 years. What am I going to do in the next 50 with that medical license? I look forward to advice and guidance. Don't forget our conference, April 26th through 28th. It's generally one of the best conferences people have ever gone to in their lifetimes. It generally inspires people for the rest of their lifetimes. It's a lovely conference. It's a fellowship. It's an inspiration. It's scientific. It's moral. It's spiritual. Not flaky. Just good, solid relationship, which I think Bob and I agree about, you know, is the essence of life. Bob, I hand the mic back to you. Anything really unusual, special, exciting you'd like to explore, not just teach about, but explore? I think you're a person who must do a lot of exploring.
Sure. I think a couple things, too. I'd go back to your journey and our journey. And as therapists, you're in the medical profession, and I'm as a therapist, our creed is to be just and fair and do no harm for our clients. And that means, you know, how can we do that? And I think the answer is to be as non-medicinal as possible, like you, and that is to try every way we can to have people get better from their emotional pain, for example, depression, anxiety, addictions, anger, narcissistic personality, obsessive compulsive, et cetera, without drugs versus drugs. And so that's where I think your and I journey is going to be in the future, is to help people understand that. And then I'm going to give you an example, which I spent to you yesterday at nighttime. Say a golfer, I deal with professional golfers, amateurs, and give them advice on the golf, but not advice, but I help them with their master their mind on a golf course. But let's take a golfer that's hitting all of his shots really good. His drives are going good. His iron shots are going good. His chipping is going good. His putting is going good. He has one part of his game that just absolutely stinks, and that is his sand shots when he's in the bunker. He cannot get it out of the bunker if his life depended on it. And now, say there's two people standing by him. One's a swing coach that can help him change his grip, his stance, his posture, help him with his, you know, releasing his feelings. And there's another person over there with a medical license that can give him medication, okay? Well, who do you think that person should go to? Most golfers would tell you, I think I'll try the non-medicinal approach because if I take any drugs or alcohol, I probably have to report it to illegal prescription drugs. I have to report it to the PGA. But the idea is that those drugs could also numb my feelings the rest of the golf round. In other words, medications numb the four senses, the four feelings. The four true feelings are joy, grief, fear, and relief. So your senses also, the five senses, hearing, touching, smelling, tasting, seeing, are numbed, which in turn numb the four feelings. So the rest of your golf round, you'll likely be not numb, but you'll be affected one way or another. Not only that, your life can be affected at home, with your friends, etc. So why wouldn't that golfer do all he can to get better in a and how should I say it, in a non-medicinal approach, whether it's legal prescription drugs or illegal ones like alcohol and drugs, like, say, for example, John Daly used. The idea is then to, why isn't that occurring on all levels? And I think I'm very compassionate to people, whether it's your, you know, psychiatrist or whether it's school counselors or et cetera. Why is there not a push towards that? I think the answer, as my book talks about, is education. We have to teach people how to properly learn from emotions, and my whole books talk about that, and that takes time. So I don't ever get angry at anybody because they don't learn. I'm compassionate to everybody. I'm very inclusive of every medical professional and mental health professional, and it just takes time, and I give them support and time. Now, if somebody has learned my approach totally, in order to learn my approach, it's sort of like taking a driver's ed class. It's going to take some time and work to learn this approach. And let's go back to what the process really is. It's going to take, usually a few months to practice this and learn this approach, how to monitor your feelings, identify them. But usually when people learn, Dr. Brigham, they go A, B, C, D, back to C, C, D, F, G, H, back to C. People regress from time to time, and that's where you need to support. So I would tell anybody that's struggling with emotions to be kind to yourself, be nice to yourself. You know, for example, a woman, why not go to the spa and get your nails done? Why not get your, do a foot massage or basically, treat yourself to whatever you like if you're trying to learn something? Don't be hard on yourself. Anger is never an approach that works well with trying to get somebody to change what they're doing. Compassion and empathy are, which what your approach is about. So that's a key thing. And at the core, I'm all about loving and respecting yourself, because when you can do that, you have more power, and then you can love other people, which is what we're all about.
Isn't it amazing that all over the world, human beings are going with these kinds of issues for help, and they need exactly what you're describing, and they're mm-hmm. getting drugs instead, mm-hmm. ruining, in effect, their golf game. Did I hear you say that getting out of that sand bunker involved releasing emotions?
Certainly. See, it is, Dr.
Steve. But is that what you said?
Well, what it is it could be this. It could be anything. You have to assess the situation properly. But what happens to people when they're like, for example, the game of golf and hitting out of the bunker, what you can learn from your emotions there. See, the person that didn't hit his bunker shot the right way, before he probably had the right way. He probably forgot it. People forget the right way to do things. So you have to, you have to get help. You have to get coaching.
So they get stuck, as you'd say, in fear.
Right, exactly. It could be fear. It most likely is fear. People do have panic attacks on the golf course. I've seen it a couple weeks ago. A guy who won the tournament, he won $1 million. He almost landed in the hospital. He had such a panic attack. He bent over. He was almost throwing up. This is a pro golfer.
He won or during the game?
It was during the round, but he bent over on his knees, almost throwing up, and he picked himself up, and he still won $1 million. People, it's very real. Do you know what it is, doctor? I have a 16-year-old client I helped with golf psychology last year, and he wasn't dating at all. He didn't have a girlfriend. He's still young, but he loved his golf. Golf is a relationship. Each shot's a relationship. He hasn't dated yet, but just like a 16-year-old boy would go through normal emotions with a girl, it's the same thing. Golf is a relationship. So it's like dealing with the emotions of a woman is a relationship. Some are hard to deal with, some not hard, but you can learn from your emotions. My book talks about different sports, but especially golf, where you can learn from your emotions rather than run away from them. I think, and staying on the topic of golfers, I just got off the phone with the top pro in Illinois. He's a friend of mine, and he's a good man. We actually won the Player of the Year this year in Illinois. But you can always learn from your emotions. You can learn from them. If you run away from them through alcohol or drugs or denying your feelings or you're getting angry, you're not going to be effective. So how do you be effective? You learn from them. So, for example, let's take that sand shot you're talking about. I'm not going to get mad at myself for missing that sand shot. Anger is just grief anyways. It's one of the four true feelings of grief. So I'm really grieving myself that I knew that I have a loss, that I knew this at one time. So I'll step back and I'll reflect and I'll try to get help and I'll try to remember how to do it right. If I don't know how to do it right, I'll take a lesson on how to do it right. Well, that's the same thing as anything else people suffer from. So let's take now example. Let's take a young man who's eating too much. I have men who are just drinking 3 or 4 beers a day and eating fast food all the time. They're going to come to me for help. I'm not going to say get angry at them or, get better in a month. I usually say well, how long have you been doing this? And they'll tell me 4 or 5 years, and they might be 40 pounds overweight, middle age with 2 kids or something. Well, I'm going to say, why don't you give yourself a couple of years to get better? Be kind to yourself, Because why? Because if somebody learns something over 3 or 4 or 5 years, it's going to take it might take that a couple of years to get better. And you have to give compassion to people, let them go at their own pace. And that goes back to my 8-step process. It's really a 5-step process, but it's 8 concepts. You have to be kind to yourself when you're learning this. You have to have support when you're doing this. You have to allow yourself to make mistakes. And then when you do that, you can finally get empowered and live a healthy life.
I think your next book should be something like, Out of the Sand Trap.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've been published before in Golf Psychology. I have an article out there called Succeeding on the Golf Course by Managing Your Emotions, which is online. But I think my next book, after talking with you, is I'm Called to Do It, is one for ages 5 to 14. It'll probably be emotional core therapy for tots or for kids. And that is because I've worked 30 years as a teacher, coach, and counselor. And I've seen so many kids, you know, just recently, you know, last year there was a situation down in California. This young 5-year-old was on 3 different medications. You know, did that medical professional try to use approaches like that I use in my book, try to teach this kid how to self-soothe himself appropriately, meditate, relax, learn about his emotions, you know, take responsibility for his actions? These things are best done before medication treatment. And so I think that's where I'm motivated. That's where my heart is. I think it's a calling, so to speak. Yeah. So that way I can stay close to you, because I think you'll like that approach too. So I like being around you.
That's cool. I'm enjoying you very much, too. One of the points I want to make about this whole issue of medication that I make occasionally, but I really need to remember people don't listen to every show or go to every one of my lectures or read all my books. I think that the therapist who finds that he's not helping his patient, the counselor, the psychiatrist, should never then say, therapy's not working, you need medication. Now, this is an arrogance. This is an arrogance that pervades the profession, the helping professions. So that here we are, we're working in a relationship with somebody who's not going as well as we want. We think the person should be getting better faster. That's our judgment. Or maybe they're feeling not getting better fast enough. And we say, well, therapy's not working, you need medication. That's utterly false. There is nothing on heaven or earth that says that therapy with you or me or Jim or Jake or Jane is the only therapy there is, that it represents all therapy. That's like dating someone and saying, well, this isn't working, you don't like me, and giving the person a roofie.
Right.
You know, the fact that as a therapist we're not able to help one or another person is a part of life. Because it's about relationship, and all relationships obviously don't work. So if you're somebody's patient or client and the therapy's not working well, never let them tell you that therefore you need medication. If anything, therefore your therapist needs a reanalysis of what they're not doing for you, or you need a reanalysis about going to seeking out a new therapist.
Right. You know, what it is, doctor, is therapy is all work. I'm working, you know, I've known that my whole life. It's I work, my clients work. It's very exhausting work. I'll tell you one thing. No one's ever come to me because they're happy. No one's ever said, Bob, I'll pay you $100 an hour because I'm joyful. It's always debilitating feelings. Now, that being said, a therapist, to answer your question, should never, I don't use the word should, because I love Albert Ellis and cognitive behavior, REBT, BT therapy. A therapist is never to give advice, because if you give someone advice, you're altering a relationship that they have. A client needs to choose what relationship he brings in and out of his life, and that's where the real power is given back to the client. So you'd never hear me say, like, I'm not a medical doctor, but I never even tell my clients what to do. I help them search through their own world about what to do. I don't have the power. And I'll give you one example, doctor. For example, now I'll joke with you so you understand this, okay, so you see this in a humorous light. What if a medical doctor said, take this medication, you know, therapy's not working. And what if the client took it and he went down to the pharmacy to take it, but in the meanwhile he went to the cash register, it was a lottery ticket, and he won the big lottery, won $5 million. So in that case, that they're going to take the medication was actually might have been beneficial. He's got $5 million, or let's say $100 billion. It's a hypothetical question. The idea is, but what if he went down the same street and took the medication and got deathly ill from it? As a therapist, okay, we are not to give advice to our clients. Why? Because it takes away their power. We want the clients to gain power by choosing their relationships and then learning how they feel from those relationships. Do you see how I'm saying? So let's take one of the questions really with, and you know, you and I know the dangers of medications, for example. It's the same as, like, you know, in some ways it could be like going into traffic. Sure, we don't want our clients to do it, but our job is to inform them. What do medications do? Medications alter the five senses, which alters the four feelings. You know, typically in your field, people come to you because they're depressed. there's not a medication out there that will not only cure the depression, but also cure, not deal with the joy, because medications are taken through the central nervous system. So medications in general, just like drugs or alcohol or marijuana, okay, they're going to alter your five senses and your four feelings. So you're not going to learn as much about the human relationships that cause you stress. So my answer to your, you know, in a roundabout way, or in a, really in a direct way to you is this, why not learn from emotional stress? Let's take, my book talks about 30 examples of debilitating stress. It could be loss of finances, jail term. It could be loss of a spouse. It could be losing a job, et cetera. These are all day in and day out tragedies that happen to people, or losses in life, or fearful events, okay? Sometimes these events take a year or two to get over. Sometimes they take 2 years. Sometimes they take 6 months, okay? And the most important thing for a client, in my eyes, to do is try in a non-medicinal way to learn from these emotions. Why? Because when you learn from your emotions, that's how you get better. Now, let's stay with this just for a second. A 22-year-old girl with a golden heart dates a boy that, you know, is on drugs, you know, and she's with him and he's not paying attention to her. You know, I would tell her, you know, when I'm talking with her, well, that's, you know, I hear your emotions. You have a lot of grief and fear over this relationship, you know. And so I don't tell her to stop dating that boy. I would say, well, how do you feel about this? And she would explore her feelings. Well, isn't that going to be much more powerful with the next person she meets? You can truly learn from all your relationships. And my book, again, talks about that, the idea that when you learn from your emotions, that's the real power, okay? And that's where you can really get stronger in life. Now that I'm 51 years old, as I said, I feel as vibrant today with no medications or drugs for the last 20 years, you know? And I've tried those things to get better, you know, but I think people have to get their own experience, to have their own experiences with whatever they use. I see people from time to time, they're like, I like smoking marijuana. You know, I'll smoke, you know, 3 days a week, you know? And it's not my role to judge them. That's where they are at their stage of life, you know? And it would be intrusive for me to say anything unless they ask for my opinion in a professional capacity.
What would you do if that person was coming to see you as a client?
Would you say anything to them? Oh, yeah, that's what we do. We take our time. You know, I let people know right away. I said, you're here. That's a great thing. It's a great day when you come for help. And why are you here? Well, because we talk about it. If you're smoking, if you're numbing yourself with marijuana, okay, you're numbing your five senses, which in turn numbs your four true feelings.
Yeah, so you would be direct about that.
No, it takes time. I just let them explore. You have to let clients go at their own pace, or else it's intrusive. We let them share their stories, and from time to time you interject, just like I'm doing with you. So it might be a third.
First of all, you have a very strong personality, and I suspect that people kind of know what you think, even if you're not saying it. My own approach, you know, which, you know, I hardly ever mention this, you know, I've got an empathic therapy training film. You can get the empathic therapy training film by going to Bregan.com.
I've seen it. I've watched it over time. Yeah.
I sell it much, much cheaper than typical. Training films are usually $200 or $300. I think we sell it for $35 or something like that. But, you know, barely above what it ultimately cost to have it made and reproduced and so on. I'm pretty direct with patients. I think over the years I've come to the conclusion that, first of all, people kind of know what I'm thinking anyway because I don't try to keep a straight face.
Right.
And the other thing is that I think a lot of times it does help people to get a little guidance. A lot of folks have never had the experience of someone caring enough about them to say, you know, well, I get scared for you when you tell me about being alone with that guy, or... Mm-hmm. You know, I think you can do a lot better in your life. So I'm a lot more direct than you're describing, but I agree with your fundamental principle, which is that the really core learning is when people are helped to see their feelings about what they're doing and why they're doing it and how it harms or helps them. But especially as I've gotten older, as you see in the training film, I think I tend to be pretty direct with people about what I think. Because in a lot of ways, I think that that's more adult and respectful to tell somebody what you think when it really matters in their lives. But on the other hand, I also can understand not doing that and taking the approach you're describing. Mm-hmm. I think it's a lot about what you're comfortable with as a person, as a therapist, as well as what you think helps or what helps in your hands. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes left.
I will say this, just to make a great point, that Irvin Yalom is a great therapist out of Stanford, a psychiatrist, and he talks about the here and now. It's really important to sense how you as a therapist are feeling, because I think other people can sense that too. So, but I think that's a key point, is you can monitor your own feelings in therapy, and then you check from there after your feeling, will that help or hurt your clients? I think the key thing, again, goes back to relationships. If I had the power to help people relate, if I had the power to prognosticate or predict the future, I would tell my clients exactly what's going to happen, but I don't have that power. I just don't know.
Well, I think that's true. That's very true. But I might tell somebody, since he beats up 3 times, I think we can expect he's going to do it a 4th. Take care
of
yourself.
Right.
Take care of yourself, my friend.
And that's what I talk
but
about.
Again,
I really talk about learning.
Go ahead. There's a lot of room for variations and approaches, and I like your enthusiasm and your caring, and I like that you're not standing off in some world of your own and evaluating people. And I love how many different things you're doing. I think I think this whole idea of sports medicine is a wonderful thing. I worked with a golfer many years ago who was a very big amateur, and who wanted before he died to become a pro. And we talked a lot about they were right on the surface for him, the emotional issues that interfered with how he swung and whether he was trying to make the best swing or swing from his own nature, or whether he was trying to hit the hole, and how when he tried to hit the hole that did not work for him, that he had to have another approach to the swing. And it was all very interesting. And it's all about life. Everything we do is all about life.
I think to make a point, Doctor, last year the top golfer in the world is Rory McIlroy. Before he won, last year he was leading a major tournament, and he had a meltdown. He had a panic attack, which is basically excess fear and some grief there, and he basically collapsed at the end and didn't win the major tournament. And then later on, he ended up winning a couple of tournaments, so he recovered. But let's skip over from golf to real life. Life is like that. We all go because we all need resources to live, so we're always taking on responsibilities like jobs and relationships, boyfriends, partners, husbands, wives, etc. And in doing so, we all can get overwhelmed from time to time, just like Rory McIlroy, the professional golfer. The idea is how to release that. Good golfers, when they hit a shot, whatever they're feeling, anger, which is just grief or fear, they release it before their next shot. Doesn't affect them, so it doesn't affect their next shot. And that's the whole key of my approach. And then let's transfer that to real life. So your boss is mean at you, you know, for 2 months he's driving you nuts, which I talk about some of these cases in my book. You know, he's overwhelming you. You know, don't let that affect your whole life for a long time. Learn to identify and release it, so then you can go to your next relationship strong, just like Rory McIlroy did. And when you can do that, when you realize the temporary state of the 4 true feelings of joy, grief, fear, and relief. You don't get as overwhelmed as much. This is a temporary state of being. You know, loss is a part of life. I'm going to work through it. And I got to tell you, Doc, having been
mentally depressed. We're going toward the end.
Okay.
I want to thank you, Bob. This has been really interesting to me. Bob Moylan, Moylan. And don't forget the Empathic Therapy Conference coming up in April. Just plug into Google Bregan Empathy. You'll find it. Hey, thanks for listening. Thanks very much.